Being Programmed to Chill, a show about business, crime, parapolitics, and esoterica, with your host, Jimmy Fallon Gong.
This is Premium Episode 17, Q&A 5, or Spies, in my new chronology study group. It's more likely than you think. Let's get into some more Q&A questions. I've been waiting to answer this one for a while, and I think it's going to be very fun. Let's see. Jonathan asks, it's clear that much of our recent history, particularly the 20th century and beyond, is misunderstood and at times purposefully crafted into a false narrative. How much of the events and happenings from the distant past that is taken for granted do you think have been given similar treatment? I would probably agree with Jonathan. I would say that history is a very complicated and misunderstood thing. And a lot of people who are not trained in history really don't understand how much uncertainty is involved, even for, like, basic facts about history. And sometimes I think people view it almost like an admission of failure or something, that we acknowledge that there are actually massive, huge swaths of time where we don't really know what was happening. And along those same lines, there are just a ridiculous amount of forgeries of ancient texts. Like, when scholars seem to express, like, high skepticism of just about anything in the past, to an outsider it looks like this weird paralysis or inability to trust anything. But, like, that's entirely grounded in reality. Some historians, the way they talk about the past, it kind of reminds me of counterintelligence work, in that they are very hesitant to say anything with absolute certainty, and that's completely rational. People don't realize how tenuous our grasp of ancient history really is. And what we do know about history is often subject to wild differences in interpretation. Like, I think some people have seen some of those documentaries that show something like the Vikings, and how just about every society in almost every decade had, like, a different read on the Vikings. And there's often crazy levels of projection or wish fulfillment and fantasy about, you know, something like the Vikings. And basically, this has been true for all of history forever. In the United States, we know that there have been battles over the history of the U.S. Civil War. There have been battles over our textbooks. Of course, we know about the obfuscation about World War II and the wars in Korea and Vietnam. A lot of people make fun of, you know, Turkey for not acknowledging the Armenian genocide, and, like, rightfully so. Or maybe Japan refusing to recognize their war crimes during World War II. But just about every society has equivalent, you know, things. And then, of course, there's just a whole range of ahistorical interpretations of the past that are not quite as flagrant, but still just as inaccurate. And this discrepancy between history and historians, it's also kind of like how science enthusiasts versus scientists just act completely different, and it really freaks people out. The idea that we don't know, like, really crucial things about the past is very unsettling. Now, Jonathan asks, how much of the past, taken for granted, was crafted into a false narrative? And of course, I don't know myself, but let's talk about it. Now, as you might expect, there's a whole range of false narratives about the past that can exist, and as a general rule, I'm generally more likely to believe a given argument that a certain aspect of history is false, you know, the more limited the claim would be, assuming the evidence is there. The larger the theory, the harder it'll be for me to believe it, right? That's true for most people, which is not to say that it's wrong. For example, in more modern times, saying Lee Harvey Oswald didn't act alone, that would be perhaps easy to prove, and, you know, it's a limited claim. But then to argue that JFK was killed in an elaborate killing of the king ritual carried out by Freemasons, that would require basically an incomprehensible burden of proof, right? So it is with falsified history claims, right? Now, one that I know about off the top of my head is that, for example, there were tons of feudal fiefdoms that had legal claims on their land based on documents that are outright forgeries. And they were outright forgeries usually because their claim to the land was some kind of massive theft, right? like possibly most of them actually, have very questionable claims to the lands that they are claiming. And wouldn't you know, most noble families of Europe claim genealogies that go back to supposedly ancient Rome or even before. But in many cases, these are fictional too. What little we can discern of ancient noble families shows them to be the ancient equivalent of gangsters and warlords, basically. And you can even see it in their nicknames. Here's another pet theory that I'm into. One of my buddies, Dakota, tipped me off about the weird deceptions around Stonehenge. Now, Stonehenge is said to have been constructed sometime around 3000 to 2000 BC, and like, I don't have any reason to doubt that claim. However, Stonehenge, as now standing, was basically reconstructed around the turn of the century, and then again in the 1950s, with subsequent work thereafter. The stones are not the same, and the current Stonehenge stones have concrete bases. Now, this might not sound like a very huge revelation because you can find photos of these reconstructions being made, but people actually get really mad when you bring it up. And by people, I mean like the Stonehenge, you know, historical society, different historians. It's kind of like reconstructing Stonehenge is not necessarily bad, but then pretending like it is the same as it's been since like 5,000 years ago, that's a little weird, right? Kind of raises some questions as to the purpose of restoring it, you know, what purposes it might serve, concepts of national heritage. You get into some very interesting waters really quick. I would love to talk about the Stonehenge question at more length, but I would definitely have to prepare for that. But do you know who owns Stonehenge? Actually, the Queen owns Stonehenge.
Great Britain is at it again!
No, don't ask anything about Stonehenge's prominence as a place of power for the neo-pagan revival in England. Let's just keep moving. What's that? You want to hear about the Queen's Pyramid? No, that's for another day. Let's keep moving. Oh, also, in terms of Britain fucking with us and making up a more ancient history than they really had, the city of York put up a statue of the Roman Emperor Constantine, right? That's fine. Supposedly he came to the UK, and so a statue of him, I guess, would make sense. However, they gave the statue a patina that made it look positively ancient. But the statue was put up in 1998, which is sort of one of those things that makes you go, I got some of this from the Russians with Attitude podcast. That's all fun, right? But what we really want to talk about is the crank stuff, because that's where things get really fun. And concepts surrounding, like, phantom time are probably some of the most crank stuff you can get into. Like, whether you want to go in, like, the Nazi direction with Hyperborea or, you know, Fomenko and his new chronology or, you know, a couple of these other guys. Let's talk about one in particular. Let's talk about Herbert Illig. Let's talk about Herbert Illig and his phantom time hypothesis. Herbert Illig was born in 1947, or should I say 1650. He, of course, came up with the phantom time hypothesis, or should I say perhaps that the historian Hans Ulrich Niemitz actually developed a similar theory first. Niemitz published a paper on it that was floating the idea, and then Illig ran with the concept. Now, the phantom time theory suggests that the Holy Roman Emperor Otto III worked with Pope Sylvester II, and possibly Emperor Constantine VII, to invent the Anno Domini dating system to place themselves at Anno Domini 1000. Thereby rewriting history to make their rule appear more legitimate. Now, Illig was also an enthusiast of catastrophism, which is a geological theory that Earth has been shaped by sudden catastrophic events like asteroids or even an entire planet. And this theory contrasts with uniformitarianism or gradualism, which pointed more to erosion bringing about the Earth's geological features. Now, there have been real academic debates about this, and the current scientific consensus holds that there were some catastrophic events that shaped Earth, but that most of Earth was shaped by uniformitarianism or gradualism. Quite separate, but not entirely separate from the academics, there is a fringe, a pseudoscience, in fact, that suggests some pretty wild things, like that Earth was hit by Venus or Mars, that Jupiter might have been in the mix, and that this happened within human history, and that this shaped our religious views, etc., etc., etc. So what you'll see going forward, because I will talk about this in future episodes, but basically phantom time theories tend to go hand in hand with catastrophism, and you'll often see people interested in both, and applying the same sort of logic to both fields. Now, to get back to the phantom time hypothesis, the basic argument was that the Middle Ages didn't exist. And Illig believed that during this period, they actually forged documents and physical evidence to carry this out. According to Illig's theory, the entire Carolingian period, including Charlemagne, is actually a fabrication. And that the years 1614 to 911, and that the years 1614 to 911 AD were entirely made up. So basically, the early Middle Ages did not happen. If you only focus on Europe, this might actually hold up. I mean, it couldn't easily be disproved, and I will go through some of the evidence for and against. So the evidence in favor of the phantom time theory includes the true scarcity of archaeological evidence for that period in question. In Europe, there really are not very many artifacts from the early Middle Ages. Now, at the time that the phantom hypothesis was created, at least posed by Illig, there were some real questions about the reliability of radiometric and dendrochronological methods of dating. Dendrochronological, of course, being tree ring methods of dating. Now, Niemitz and Illig both pointed out that Romanesque architecture had a huge level of prominence in the 10th century in Western Europe. They point to that as proof that the Roman era was much closer than we thought. Then there are the genuine and annoying sloppy inaccuracies between the Julian and Gregorian calendars, which always cause confusion. But maybe the best piece of evidence, like I mentioned, was the extremely high number of truly, provably, demonstrably falsified documents from the Middle Ages. We're talking fake names, fake dates, fake people, fake agreements, and fake contracts. There was actually a historical conference in Munich in 1986 that specifically studied this problem. Now, what they found was that the Catholic Church actually forged most of these documents, but that's not entirely to lay the blame just at their feet, because in some cases they were the only people who knew how to read. It's also not to say that this was a centralized decision. If anything, the results of this conference suggest that individual monasteries and bishops seemed to mostly act on their own to legitimize their own claims and standing. It raises questions, but that evidence does not seem to point to 600 years of completely falsified history. Now, what are the arguments against the phantom time hypothesis? As you might guess, there is an overwhelming amount of evidence against it. First of all, and if I don't say this in the spirit of debunking, right? Like, we all hate debunkers, but, you know, often they're right. And so it is with this. So we can look at the fact that there are a bunch of artifacts from that period in other parts of the world. Ancient astronomy matches modern observations, suggesting that there was no phantom time period. Timelines in China and non-Western Europe don't reflect the phantom time hypothesis either. And radiometric and dendrochronological methods, you know, got a lot better, and they don't reflect the phantom time hypothesis either. Nor is there reason to believe that all the radiometrics and dendrochronology experts are in a cabal lying to us, right? Now, I'm no expert on history or science, but to me, what Illig's phantom time hypothesis should teach us is just that we know so little about the Middle Ages in Western Europe that there was a fairly plausible, if incorrect, theory suggesting the period didn't even happen, since we know so little about it. Now, that's interesting. You can also take it another direction, which is fair, which, you know, you can talk about how, you know, people can be educated enough to hang themselves, right? But not educated enough to not fall down such a weird rabbit hole. Illig shows us how real knowledge can be harnessed for completely wrong-headed ideas, right? Sounds like a classic case of being smart enough to get yourself into trouble, but not smart enough to avoid it altogether, right? 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 Or was there something else going on? To answer that, of course, we need to get into who Herbert Illig was, and I hope you are sitting down, because although this sounds very boring, this is a truly wild ride. Seriously, like, I had some suspicions. I'll probably say this at the end too, but I had some suspicions, but what I found boggled my mind, like, completely blew me away. So Herbert Illig had a doctorate in art history from the University of Bremen, and he worked as a systems analyst. Take note of that, dear listener, a systems analyst. He was a systems analyst at a bank before he quit to work as a journalist. Now, he was a leading member of the pseudoscientific, my designation, not theirs, the Pseudoscientific Society for the Reconstruction of Human and Natural History. This group was based, I think, in Germany. I say I think because it might have been Switzerland, but there were members in both countries. This group had a sister study group in London called the Society for Interdisciplinary Studies. Now, if you're taking notes, the Society for Interdisciplinary Studies acronym is SIS. SIS, of course, being the actual acronym for MI6, the British Intelligence Agency.
Real spy shit!
It sort of strains credulity. Now, I know what you're saying, like, that sounds like a coincidence, but let's get into it some more. And when you consider names like Bernie Madoff, like Madoff with the money, or the media company The Intercept, which just so happens to intercept whistleblowers, no, I do not think that this was an accident. Now, what were these Swiss, Germans, and Brits doing with their new chronology studies? Well, the whole phantom time theory was deeply informed, probably invented, you could probably say, at least in its modern incarnation, by a guy named Emanuel Velikovsky. Who was Emanuel Velikovsky? So I have an episode on him coming up in the future, but Velikovsky came from a Jewish White Russian family. He studied under Freud. He knew Freud. Velikovsky worked as a psychiatrist in the British Mandate in Palestine. Now, during World War II, Velikovsky spent his time working out an elaborate catastrophist cosmology. And later on, he would revise world history, making a new chronology, basically. In the 50s, Velikovsky published a book, Worlds in Collision. The book Worlds in Collision argues that Venus used to be a moon of Jupiter, but it broke free and passed Earth during ancient human history. The book argues that this was massively influential on our world cultures and religions. Now, it sort of goes without saying that there's basically no proof for this being true. Like, no astronomers with tenure or real credentials believe this. Basically no real historians. But, interestingly, the book Worlds in Collision got positive coverage from Harper's Magazine and Reader's Digest. As we've discussed, that doesn't just happen by accident, right? Now, I would call all of Velikovsky's career bizarre and anomalous, because he is savagely maligned by academics, but he's beloved by the public. Not least of which because he's given speaking engagements to appear across universities all across North America and the British Commonwealth. The CBC made a documentary about him, the BBC made another. I'm pretty sure there was one or two in the US. Oh, and It should go without saying that he was an ardent Zionist, like, obviously, right? Now, Velikovsky actually did have some, I guess I would just say, people he copied, but he was basically the first and definitely the most prominent person to run with this theory, and certainly the first to get professional PR for it, right? Now, Velikovsky likened himself to the 16th century heretical friar Giordano Bruno, which might be pretty accurate in a certain sense, if not necessarily the one that he meant. Also, not to dwell too much on Velikovsky, but functionally speaking, his theories placed Israel at the center of the new chronology, and it sort of played a Velikovsky's ideas sort of played a prefigurative role towards what would become intelligent design. Like, he's sort of a bridge between older versions of creationism and current modes of intelligent design. So you can see why that would be both popular and instrumentalized, perhaps, by certain groups of people, right? Now, let's talk about that Society for the Reconstruction of Human and Natural History group that Herbert Illig was in. Now, this one, the SIS group, like, we're talking, like, maybe a dozen active members in each location, and then maybe a couple dozen more subscribing to their publications, right? This is not a particularly huge group of people, but they did all know each other. They worked on publications together, they met and discussed new chronology and catastrophism together, and they corresponded, the German group and the British group, right? Now, I will hold off on discussing the SIS for the Velikovsky episode, but focusing on the German group, there was a guy named Christoph Marx. Now, Christoph Marx was Emanuel Velikovsky's personal representative in Germany. He lived and worked in Switzerland, however. Much like Illig, Christoph Marx was a systems analyst and an early computer expert. Remember, systems analyst. Interesting, right? Now, here's where the story gets really strange. So in 1975, the Soviets landed a probe on Venus. The probe, the Venera 9, landed and managed to operate for 53 minutes. And, I mean, I'm sure a lot of us in school learned the very extreme conditions on the surface of Venus. The probe managed to send pictures back to Earth. It was a world historic achievement. It was the first time pictures had ever been taken of another planet's surface. There's a whole host of other firsts as well, but that, I think, is the most notable one. Well, Velikovsky argued that based on some finding that the Venera 9 probe had, I think it was hydrocarbons being on Venus's surface, Velikovsky argued that this was a huge vindication of his theory, right? Because the theory was that Venus passed by Earth close enough, I guess, to absorb hydrocarbons. I don't know. I mean, he said that it was fulfilling a prediction that he had, because he made a whole host of predictions of things that would vindicate him later, right? People like Carl Sagan spent a lot of time trying to debunk Velikovsky, and he argued about the particulars, right? But you can look that up, or maybe I'll get into it, you know, in the next episode. But here's the interesting thing. All the Velikovskyites, they all felt vindicated too, right? And so after the Soviet probe and that whole thing, Christoph Marx actually wrote to the Soviets. In his letter, he said that Soviet science would have been better served by studying Emanuel Velikovsky's works. He said that the Soviet Union could have saved billions in their space program by studying what Velikovsky had to say about Venus before. Now, in both the grandiosity and the delusionality, this reminds me quite a bit of Lyndon LaRouche and his U.S. Labor Party, his National Caucus of Labor Committees, the LaRouche cult, right? But the similarities do not stop there. Now, as the story goes, whether the Soviets were genuinely persuaded by Velikovsky's theories, as presented by Marx, or whether they just wanted to keep track of Christoph Marx and the Velikovsky group, they started meeting with Marx and buying his monthly reports. And by monthly reports, I am talking about Christoph Marx selling real scientific data to the Soviets. And then Christoph Marx was arrested by Swiss federal security authorities for espionage. Did he have access to, and who was Christoph Marx really? To explain what Christoph Marx was up to, I'm afraid I'll need to introduce one more person. But don't worry, it'll pay off. And yes, I'm aware that I introduced Illig only to introduce Velikovsky, only to introduce Marx, now to introduce Dick Grazia. But I promise it'll pay off. Let's talk about this guy, Alfred Dick Grazia. Now, allow me to read you Wikipedia's two-sentence introduction to who Alfred de Grazia is. Alfred de Grazia, 1919-2014, was born in Chicago, Illinois, was a political scientist and author. He developed techniques of computer-based social network analysis in the 1950s, developed new ideas about personal digital archives in the 1970s, and defended the catastrophism thesis of Emanuel Velikovsky, unquote. Now, a couple things should stand out right away. The chilling phrase, he developed techniques of computer-based social network analysis in the 1950s. That's pretty scary. Developed new ideas about personal digital archives in the 1970s. Also pretty scary. And defended the catastrophism thesis of Emanuel Velikovsky. Concerning, not necessarily scary. In short, de Grazia was a spy. Though what I read to you shouldn't necessarily make that super obvious, but let's get into it. So de Grazia went to the University of Chicago, and then to Columbia Law. So ding, ding, ding on both of those schools. Then he served in World War II. Guess what he did in World War II? You guessed it. He was in intelligence and psychological warfare. He was actually working on psychological warfare in World War II and the Korean War. He actually helped write manuals of psychological warfare for the CIA during the Korean War. He also organized and investigated psychological operations for the United States Defense Department during the Vietnam War. Now, it doesn't really stop being sus either. De Grazia taught at the University of Minnesota and Brown, and then he was appointed director of the Committee for Research in the Social Sciences at Stanford University, supported by a Ford Foundation grant. Chilling work at a chilling place through chilling funds. Now, de Grazia did not get tenure at Stanford. I couldn't completely figure out why, but since I'm planning on revisiting de Grazia in the future, I will figure it out. But I'm sure his politics didn't help, because the American Enterprise Institute published several of his books to give you some idea of where he stood. Now, de Grazia got into Velikovsky and his theories in the 1960s. He actually met and interacted with Velikovsky. He wrote two books on Velikovsky's theories, and he actually dedicated the entire September 1963 issue of his publication, The American Behavioral Scientist, dedicated the whole edition to the Velikovsky affair, which I will talk about the Velikovsky affair in the future. Now, later in life, in the 1970s, de Grazia founded the, quote, University of the New World, unquote. He founded that in Switzerland. And that was a university in the loosest sense of the word. It was designed to be an unstructured alternative to American universities. Unstructured alternative is also another way of saying that it was unaccredited and soon to collapse. But while it was up and running, de Grazia invited the beat author and known spy William S. Burroughs to teach there. Now, in a biography of William S. Burroughs, the biographer Ted Morgan described the students that were attracted to the University of the New World as, quote, drifters and dropouts on the international hippie circuit. Morgan suggested that this resulted in a culture clash with the prim Swiss. And for sure, if I were to put a new university with no structure, I would certainly not choose Switzerland. Unless, of course, it was, you know, for some other reason, right? And Morgan noted that the University of the New World lacked adequate facilities or a sound business model. Now I can hear you now, dear listener, saying, why, Jimmy? Why are you bringing all this up? This guy sounds like a freak, true, but where are we going with this? Well, thank you for asking. Alfred de Grazia, while he was living in Switzerland running this fake school, this stupid hippie university, in the 1970s, he was doing a lot more than just that. He was the handler for Christoph Marx. As far as I can tell. And when I say as far as I can tell, I am pretty certain, because Alfred de Grazia wrote a whole book on it called The Fall of Spydom, Memoir of a Case of Espionage, with Reflections and Digressions upon Catastrophism, Pandemic Paranoia, Computers, War Games, Mythology, and Swiss Savoir-Vivre. And it is probably one of the most insane books that I have ever read. So, through a quirk of, I guess, the topics that I happened to pick, I actually ended up reading James Shelby Downard's autobiography back-to-back with this book. And I would say they paired nicely in that they are both totally insane. Now, of course, Downard is closer to the schizophrenic side, and DeGrazia's book is much more on the maybe like insane narcissist side, but, you know, they're both pretty nuts. Now, The Fall of Spydom is, I wouldn't say it's necessarily easy to read, but it is extremely funny, because half of the book is DeGrazia going, but what is spying? And whomst among us has not done some spying? I'll read from a few passages. How many times have I heard my friends say that so-and-so, a mutual acquaintance or stranger in the news, was assuredly a spy? And from time to time, I have had to endure their speculations about myself. People are naturally paranoid. Spying emerges as a deep, paranoiac wish projected onto others. These are snippets, right? They aren't all connected, so this isn't one paragraph. An ordinary definition is best. Spying and espionage is the forbidden transfer of knowledge from one's government domain to another's. The domain can also be private, corporate, or personal. They do not see the reality. The little lady with the green eyeshade poring over the latest catalog of the Azerbaijan jelly industry. It is espionage because it would be so regarded by the Soviet Union, though its arm cannot reach her. Maybe 95% of espionage is just this, I say. But from the smirks I get, you would think that there is jam on my mustache, and that I call up the scene because, well, that's the way to mislead people, isn't it? Generally speaking, covert spying is useless or worse. Overt intelligence is bureaucratic and goes unused the farther up the ladder of decision it must climb. There is no cause for alarm, even without being in the government. I can get you as good a reading as any outfit anywhere, tomorrow, regarding any crisis, personage, party, lobby, weapon system, prospective event, etc. How? By telephoning into my network of knowledgeable people and making sense out of their responses. Long before computers were in use, a few of us were cognizant of network theory and of how to zero in to the informed types for critical intelligence. A large and covert CIA intelligence operation had free run of the Iranian monarchy and drew upon an allied espionage system of great size. Summing it all up, the CIA could report to the White House that the Shah's regime was stable and well in command of the country. This 6 months before a violent revolution overthrew the regime. A man named Roosevelt was in charge of the operation to keep the Shah on top. I wonder whether he was the strange young officer I caught snooping among my papers in a via several of us occupied before crossing into Sicily in 1943. Don't be too harsh, Alex, advised my British friend Robbie. That was a harmless lad. Name of Roosevelt. Belongs to the OSS. I agreed. A scholarly type. Couldn't help rifling through papers. Or again, the General Accounting Office condemns some very lax procedures with regards to visits by foreign nationals at our weapons facilities. Apparently some nuclear bomb suspects like Israel, Pakistan, Brazil, and Argentina have been getting intelligence agents invited into jolly visits at Los Alamos, Sandia, and Livermore labs. I may seem to be too fascinated with the linguistics of espionage to be kosher, but it's part of my cover. It is the best cover, and you have to believe it. The abstracted philosopher, the removed professor, retired now, thus even better. There was once such pressure to take on good covers that the CIA was paying to put its people through college and into professorships just in order to cover them as spies. Histoire proteron, the cart before the horse. But now old professors are being hired, cheaper, more reliable, less trigger-happy, or at least this is what I have heard said, don't quote me, unquote. So you see what I mean, right? Like, sometimes he's going off at like 60 miles an hour, and you don't always even know what he's saying, and you have to listen back and like sort of follow the train of thought, right? The whole book is like that. It was actually kind of exhausting to read, though extremely rewarding. And despite half of it being almost unintelligible, it is extremely quotable. I'll give him that. And despite half the time not knowing exactly what he's saying, the book is extremely quotable. I will give him that. Now, to get back to Christoph Marx. When Marx was arrested, the Swiss prosecutors said that he had caused major damage. A Swiss newspaper wrote, "Case of espionage discovered, Swiss citizen jailed, Soviet diplomat expelled." I quote from the Swiss article. A first secretary of the Soviet embassy at Bern has been declared persona non grata for engaging in forbidden intelligence gathering activities. In retaliation, the Soviet Union has expelled a Swiss diplomat. Police and judicial investigation led by the federal prosecutor, in close cooperation with the police of the Canton of Basel, has produced evidence of prolonged economic and political espionage by the Soviet diplomat Pyotr Leonidov. The aforesaid diplomat took over and consolidated after October 1986 an intelligence relationship that had been established and built up by his predecessor. Himself declared an undesirable person and expelled in the summer of 1986, with an active computer expert of Swiss citizenship. On the occasion of numerous conspiratorial meetings in diverse places in Switzerland, intelligence from the EDP domain was transmitted. The Soviet attempted also, the investigation so far reveals, to obtain, relying upon the financial difficulties in which the Basel businessman found himself stuck, information through him from Swiss and foreign databanks in the areas of economics and science, unquote. Yes, there was some awkwardness with the translation, for sure. The article appeared in June 9th, 1987. Later on, it became public knowledge that the man that the Swiss authorities had arrested for spying for the Soviets was named Marx. And the date of his arrest was April 1st. History is all one big joke. Now, how did Christoph Marx get on the Soviets' radar in the first place? For one thing, Marx had joined the Swiss-Soviet Friendship Association. They're operating in Switzerland. But also, Marx happened to meet a Soviet heart specialist, Professor Dr. Medvedev. Now, this doctor was visiting the Sandoz Pharmaceutical Company. Now, if you'll recall, dear listener, Sandoz Laboratories, of course, is owned by the Anglo-Jewish Warburg family. Now, as the story goes, it's actually the Sandoz laboratory employees who had the doctor meet Marx. Marx had contracted to work with Sandoz computers, if I understand correctly. The Soviet doctor and Marx were, quote, discussing the need in the Soviet Union for the kind of powerful personal computers that were then appearing for the first time in the West. They would be useful in various kinds of experimental research, for example, in animal cardiac studies of the type then being conducted at Sandoz. The computers registered simultaneously and continuously a variety of signals from different animals under observation and test, unquote. Of course, I can only imagine that the animal cardiac studies were in relation to LSD, though this is speculation on my part. Obviously, Sandoz does a lot more than just invent and test LSD, but I think it's fair to speculate either way. Christoph Marx appears to have worked with the Soviets over a good 20 years. He would sell them computers and technology, but he also sold intelligence and secrets. Now, in the words of Alfred de Grazia, keep that in mind, Christoph Marx's qualifications for espionage would, quote, make the mouth of a CIA recruitment agent water. He had attended public school in England and spoke English fluently. He belonged to several excellent cover groups, the PAF, which was the Podium for Academic Freedom, the SIS, the Society for Interdisciplinary Studies, and Kronos, a publishing circle. Expert Systems of Great Britain, which was a consortium for artificial intelligence, of which more later. The SIS and Expert Systems were both British, the first into ancient catastrophes and chronology, the second into computer simulation of intelligence behavior. Both are far out, need I warn you. Unquote. So the PAF, the SIS, Kronos, all of those are Velikovsky related. De Grazia continued, saying, he maintained a logically necessary international network of correspondents and could attend conferences naturally on practically any subject anywhere with a good excuse. This was the same kind of network that I have. Mine is even much broader, as I shall get into explaining later, too. And it is my problem as it was his opportunity. So Marx was hired at a modest price in the jargon of the trade, the spy trade, that is. Comint and Elint, communications intelligence and electronics intelligence. It is often called garbage after its major component. Unquote. Notice, of course, that De Grazia explicitly cites this new chronology group as a good cover for talking to weird people about weird things and traveling and corresponding, right? But what is the deal? Seinfeld voice, what's the deal with catastrophism and new chronology? Was it just a cover, as the Swiss prosecutors argued? Was catastrophism and new chronology Christoph Marx's primary motive, as his defenders argued? I should side note here, Christoph Marx's defenders, such as they are, argued that he was spying for the Soviets in order to popularize Velikovsky's theories, which is, you know, pretty crazy. Is there something more complicated going on? Let's listen to what De Grazia has to say, and mind you, nothing he says should be entirely trusted, but, quote, in Marx's ideas, and nobody in the world will deny that I am precisely the person to say so, was the potential for a tremendous psychological warfare campaign against the West, calling into existence and supporting, hear ye, all ye communist cells, calling into existence and supporting a cult that would denounce and combat every effort on the part of NATO nations to arm themselves materially and psychologically against the Redlands. For every hand that brandished a weapon would be paralyzed, for signifying a resurrection of world destruction. Unquote. Now, obviously I'm no expert on psychological warfare, but I do kind of agree with him, actually. New chronology has the potential to be a tremendous attack on the West. And no, I don't mean that in like a Russia gateway or like a neocon way. But it is very much like how magically everyone advancing the ideas of hollow earth, flat earth, breakaway civilizations, the only people talking about these things are either Nazis or magicians or spies, or, you know, some mixture thereof. You could even perhaps call it weaponized disinformation, or, I don't know, weaponized ideology or something, I don't know. And as for who's behind it and to what ends, that is a very different and much more complicated question. But let's remember, if we tally things up, Velikovsky was Israeli, Marx was Swiss, selling secrets to the Soviets, which is something that Anglo-Jewish-Dutch networks would, in fact, do. I think hardline CIA guys used to complain about how anytime they told the Israelis anything, within like 2 days, they had sold those secrets to the Soviets. And of course, De Grazia was CIA. So there you go. But as with all espionage, the way things play out tell you about as much about the contents of what's being spied on, right? Especially if you can't have access to what, you know, was actually handed over. So, if we go through the case, Christoph Marx was actually arrested secretly. So they didn't release very much to the press until weeks and months later. This was quasi-legal. There was some gray area in Swiss law that they kind of skirted on, but that's a more complicated story. But the authorities chose to release some limited details right away. They didn't have to, which means the authorities had one of the three scenarios. Either they wanted to get Christoph Marx and they got him, or two, they were proud of their work, or three, they were using him as a ploy to flush someone else out, or of course some combination thereof. And while this all happened, DeGrazia was there, in the mix. He wrote about finding his apartment bugged. He said, quote, "So now both the Americans and the French think that I may be working for the other and setting things up in Switzerland. The Swiss feel that I may be working for either the French or the Americans, if not the Russians. Suppose that I am a lone wolf operator. I could be working on my own behalf against the Swiss, French, Russians, and Americans, selling and buying as the case arises, like a trafficker in weapons. The difference is that I have found sources of information rather than weapons that all four governments would like to possess, although I could get a hold of weapons too. Next, suppose I work for one against one, or two, or three of the others. And if the possibility of my being here or there in the capacity of an industrial spy for a great American multinational company which shall remain unnamed, why, the possibilities go up again." Unquote. So you see, it's usually not quite as cut and dry as CIA, Soviets, right? He could be in the mix with the French, the Swiss, one of these multinationals. Also, side note, apropos of nothing, Alfred de Grazia includes the following passage. "My dear, svelte, smart niece Cindy has devoted the decades of her life since adolescence to a mean little group called the National Caucus of Labor Committees, directed by a wizard named LaRouche, originally a computer programmer. There it is again, without pay or for a bare subsistence, and with fanatic loyalty. The group is as paranoiac as can be found anywhere, not excluding Jones' People of God, who committed mass suicide in Guyana. As paranoid as you can get without the screaming sirens betokening the coming of the whitecoats. Its ideology is obscurantist, its style scientoid and ferociously accusatory. Its targets seem to occur almost by random selection and range from the Rockefellers to the Soviet Politburo. It is totally professional in tactics and media use, utterly unscrupulous, tightly bossed. Its propaganda is a blend of Marxism and fascism and technocracy, with some anti-Semitism for good measure. It affords vivid proof of the psychopathology of politics, when the whole world is viewed through a paranoid screen. Proof once again, as with the integralist Catholics of Switzerland, that fear and hate are the most effective energy mobilizers of politics and espionage." Unquote. So, my words here. First of all, it's pretty weird to describe your niece as svelte, but, you know, whatever. It's also amazing and suspicious that his niece was in the LaRouche cult. And he's right in pointing out that LaRouche worked as a programmer and a management consultant, which is not really discussed enough. And I love his analysis of the LaRoucheans as paranoid as can be found anywhere. Very interesting, right? And of course, we all know that intelligence is always a family affair. So if someone has a relative in the intelligence community, just be aware of that fact. To finish up with Christoph Marx. At the end of the day, he was found guilty of two counts of transmitting economic information. He was acquitted on the rest of the economic espionage allegations, and he was acquitted of all of the political espionage charges. The sentence for what he was found guilty of was 45 days in jail and 2 years probation. He had already served 51 days in jail upon arrest, and had been under surveillance for 2 years, so there was nothing left of the sentence, and he was free to go that same day. Now, what's interesting about this is that there is actually a very high degree of likelihood that the Swiss authorities could have convicted him of more charges, but that they squashed them because they did not want to reveal that their banking system had been penetrated and compromised. That's speculation on my part. But if you read DeGrazia's book, Between the Lines, that's all but certain what happened. Now, I know that I got very far afield from Jonathan's question, as I want to do, but I think this was instructive. There is something deeply wrong with the field of new chronology and catastrophism, and it isn't just that it's probably historically and scientifically wrong. At a sheer minimum, the fringe field appears to be used as a cover for being a weirdo, doing suspicious things, traveling, gathering scientific data that you don't really have a valid reason to have, and interacting with people beyond the norm of, like, who normal people would interact with, right? As we recall, Christoph Marx was a systems analyst. There wouldn't be a normal reason for him to have, like, astronomical data, you know, data from other sciences, unless you were using the excuse that you were trying to do Velikovskian-style studies, but really you were just selling it to the Soviets, selling the scientific research to the Soviets, right? And if you want to get, like, really James Jesus Angleton mindset, why, new chronology would be an excellent psychological operation, because even choosing to engage with it is just a massive fucking waste of time. And getting people to believe mindfuck type stuff is an entry point for other extremist beliefs, like, I don't know, say the Jewish question, of which, yes, of course, I'm glad you asked. Yes, of course the new chronologists have takes on the Holocaust, which are, you know, just chef's kiss. Very good takes, right? I couldn't get a hold of this piece, but Christoph Marx actually wrote something called, quote, Holocaust for Lucifer, which appeared in one of their publications. I'm sure that that was a completely respectable, normal take on the Holocaust, right? And at the end of the day, we can't forget that the London-based New Chronology Group is, of course, called the Society for Interdisciplinary Studies, or SIS. And just like British Secret Intelligence Service, there's really no reason to believe any of these people for anything they say. Certainly not for new chronology, catastrophism, or really any aspect of their lives. Now, I'm basically certain that if you were to also trace Flat Earth back far enough, you will find similar spooky shit. I know for a fact that that's true for Hollow Earth. All of this stuff is psyops. And I cannot stand gormless liberals who spend valuable time on this earth trying to debunk it. Stop believing people have good intentions. We have an unprecedented number of bad actors in society. Like, never before in human history have there probably been so many people whose literal job it is to lie and carry out psychological operations. We're talking spies, cops, criminal informants. Like, we've probably never had this many professional liars ever. And we need to harden up because it's only going to get worse. Like, a lot worse. But at the same time, and to end on a positive note, we can figure all this out. Like, dear listener, I had almost like an indescribable amount of joy at accidentally finding that there was a Soviet spy ring embedded within the new chronology movement. It brought such a smile, like I could not stop laughing. The world is endlessly interesting, and you can always have a good time if you try. For sources today, of course, I used the Alfred de Grazia book, The Fall of Spydom, Memoir of a Case of Espionage with Reflections and Digressions Upon Catastrophism, Pandemic Paranoia, Computers, War Games, Mythology, and Swiss Savoir Vivre, along with various newspaper articles that confirmed the contours of this story. And of course, I looked at a bunch of articles from the Society for the Reconstruction of Human and Natural History and the Society for Interdisciplinary Studies. I already mentioned, but in the future I will be doing a Velikovsky episode, which will necessarily mean more Alfred de Grazia. And I didn't get into it because we're already running long on this episode, but there is so much choice stuff in de Grazia's books I will definitely be quoting from him in the future. Thank you for listening, dear listeners. You are already on the Patreon side, so just tell a friend about the show. If you have fun, if you feel like you learned something, tell your closest friend, and hopefully we can get them listening too. Either way, thanks for subscribing. See you next episode, and God bless.